And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the show that brings you some of the most important, incisive individuals on the planet today. And today's Hank Unplugged is no exception. I have the opportunity to talk to Robert Spencer. And quite frankly, he's someone that I think of in heroic terms. And we'll talk about that as we go through the broadcast today. Robert, I am really, really excited to have you on this broadcast.
Well, I am so happy to be here, Hank, and thank you very much.
I've had you on the broadcast, and I have you on the podcast. You're the director of Jihad Watch. Tell me a little bit about that.
Jihad Watch is dedicated to exposing and explaining the motivating ideology behind jihad terror. It's something that has been obscured to a tremendous degree by the mainstream media and even by the U.S. government. And so at Jihad Watch, we have a news and commentary website, which is at jihadwatch.org, that gives you daily updates on jihad activity in the U.S. and around the world, and also explains with commentary why these things are happening, what the justification for terrorist acts is within Islamic teaching, and why Muslims continue to behave in this way, despite the condemnations by Muslim leaders of terror activity.
You know, one of the things that I oftentimes point out with respect to Islam is you've essentially have three or four options. I mean, you can say the Shahada, you can become a dhimmi, you can succumb to the sword, and now Islam is growing through what I call squattering. In other words, migration without assimilation, the python swallowing its prey with a long and slow digestion. So the work that you're involved in is not peripheral work. I mean, this is really central to what's going on in the world today.
Well, I would think so, certainly. I mean, there is a concerted effort in this immigration without assimilation to which you refer to overwhelm the West demographically. As a matter of fact, just moments before we started this show, I was watching a video of Muslim refugees, so-called, in Germany, noting that Germans were only having a few children, two at most, whereas Muslims were in Germany were having six or seven, and with four wives, that was 20-some children per person. And these young men who were saying this to a German journalist were quite forthright in saying that Allah has granted them the conquest of Germany, not by means of armies, but simple demographics.
Yeah, a country or a civilization that becomes Islamic demographically will inevitably become Islamic politically as well.
Yes, and this is because Islam has an intrinsic political component that Western authorities remain steadfast in ignoring and denying the existence of. But nonetheless, it does exist. And with the growing numbers of Muslims in the West, you're inevitably going to have an increase in the calls for the implementation of various aspects of the Islamic political program. And the West has already made numerous concessions on that score. For example, it's just taken for granted nowadays in the mainstream media that you do not criticize Islam. You don't say anything critical about Muhammad or the Quran or Allah. If you do, you're a racist, bigoted Islamophobe. No such criticism is allowed in the public square. And that is a provision of Islamic law, that criticism of Allah and the Quran and Islam in general are banned. And so the West is already beginning to accept the idea that Sharia principles have to be implemented in the West without even realizing that that's what's happening. And so once you open the door to that, it just keeps going, and it will keep going unless there is resistance at some point until Sharia is fully implemented.
You're the author of almost 20 books on Islam, and when I was writing my book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion, I read every one of your books, and as I was reading through your books, I was thinking about the fact that not only are you very witty in writing. I mean that as a compliment. I mean, titles are just absolutely, everybody must get stoned, by the way. I love that.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, but to do what you have done is a labor of love. I mean, it's a labor of love for Western civilization. I know what it takes to write a book, and what you have done for Western civilization, the good is incalculable.
all my work has been with the underlying goal of trying to defend and preserve Western civilization and Judeo-Christian principles and the understandings of human rights that we have in the West that are generally accepted around the world, with the notable exception of Islamic countries. And so, and those, that is, in particular, the ones that are under Islamic law. And so it's something, it's kind of ironic that people think that what I've been doing all these years is negative, whereas, in my view, it's completely positive and is designed to try to show people that there is a vastly better way of life offered in the traditions of the West than in Islamic.
Although I'd have to say that there is a lot of hate speech in your books. In fact, it all comes from the quotations. You're quoting hate speech that comes right out of Islam.
Yeah, exactly. The irony is that for years now, I've pointed out the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is the 57 Muslim governments, the massive organization that is the largest voting bloc at the United Nations and an international organization that for years is trying to compel the West to accept Islamic blasphemy laws and to criminalize criticism of Islam, that they have never said a word when Muslims say, kill them wherever you find them, or the Jews are our worst enemies, or all these things that are in the Quran. But when I quote the Muslim clerics saying these things, then they put that in their Islamophobia list. And it suddenly becomes hate speech when I quote them. But you're absolutely right, Hank. The real hate speech here is coming from the Quran and from Islamic tradition, and not from those of us who are trying to call attention to the reality of these things.
You wrote The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades, and I want to focus for a moment on what you have been able to communicate to Western civilization with respect to the Crusades. Oftentimes when you get in a discussion about jihad, the first thing that comes up is, well, this is precisely how Christianity advanced as well. And then you hear about all of the atrocities that occurred in the Crusades. There's a perspective that we ought to know about this, and that perspective is that the Crusades were largely a defensive action against an almost impotent Eastern Church that was being absolutely bludgeoned by the Islamic hordes.
Yeah, that's right. There were 450 years of jihad attacks that had overwhelmed what were largely Christian lands before that. The holdings of the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, which was a Christian entity, and that included all of North Africa and the Middle East, what's considered nowadays to be the heart of the Islamic world. And starting in the 7th century, these lands were conquered and Islamized. In the year 1071 at Manzikert in Asia Minor, what is now Turkey, the Byzantines suffered a tremendous defeat at the hands of the Ottoman armies, and essentially all of Asia Minor was lost, and the Byzantine emperor, Alexius Comnenus, in great alarm, appealed to the Pope and the kings of the West for help, and the Crusades were a response to that. So in the first place, they were a much delayed reaction because these conquests began in the 7th century, but it wasn't until 1099 that the Western armies arrived in the Holy Land. And they were a small-scale reaction because all of North Africa and the Middle East had been lost to Christendom, but only the Holy Land was the target of any kind of resistance and any kind of pushback in the Crusades. And finally, they were ultimately something that was defensive because most of the time nowadays you hear about the Crusades as if they were a completely gratuitous attack by the Western armies, proto-colonialist armies, on Muslims who were just minding their own business in their indigenous homelands, when actually they were a response to these conquests and an attempt to protect the Holy Land for Christian pilgrims who were being widely attacked and enslaved and in other ways harassed in the Holy Land at that time. And to try to reverse a trend that had led to the destruction of thousands literally thousands of churches in the Holy Land in the 100 years before the Crusaders arrived. Now, this is not to say that everything they did was good and or to justify all of their actions, but there is no doubt that the Crusades, in their conception, in the vision that they had originally of simply trying to reclaim some of this land and protect people, there was nothing wrong with this. And the idea that's been put forward by people such as Bill Clinton and others after 9/11, that the suspicion between the West and the Islamic world began because of the Crusades and was caused by the Crusades, is ahistorical and fantastic. It meshes with the politically correct rewriting of history that is so common today, but when you actually look at the actual history, you don't see it borne out at all.
You know, I want to get back to maybe something about you as a person. I mean, what would motivate you early on in your career to say, this is what I'm going to devote my legacy to warning the West about the threat of Islam? And I think we also have to make the clarification that you are not someone that dislikes Muslims. Muslims are people. Your problem is with a religion that enslaves. But you have a body of work that is probably unprecedented when it comes to Islam. Talk about how you got into this.
Well, you know, Hank, I appreciate in the first place the distinction, because it's a conflation really that's made by Islamic groups and leftist groups in the United States, that if you speak about how Islamic jihadis use the teachings of Islam to justify violence and hatred, then you're the problem. You're a racist and a bigot and you hate all Muslims. And of course, this has always been a calumny and always been a falsehood, but that has not prevented it from being often repeated. In any case, I got into this because of my family background, and that just sparked an interest within me when I was very young. My grandparents were actually from the Ottoman Empire, the last caliphate, unless you count the Islamic State or ISIS. And the last caliphate is, of course, the precursor of modern Turkey, and it was abolished by the founder of modern Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, in 1924. Before that, though, there had been a considerable period of time when the Orthodox Christians of that area were being persecuted by the Muslims because of the loss of the Greek province in Europe, what is now Greece, the independent country of Greece. It was an Ottoman province for several hundred years after the conquest of Constantinople in 1453. And then in 1821, the Greeks declared their independence and were able to sustain it and make it good. Now, there was at that time the concept of enosis, the idea that all the Greeks should be in one polity, in one political nation, one political entity. And so there was a push on the part of Greeks in Europe, as well as Greeks in Turkey, who'd been there from time immemorial, since the time of, you know, Helen of Troy and all that. There was a push on the part of the Greeks in Constantinople and all of Western Asia Minor, which is where my family is from, to be united with the Greeks in an independent Greek state, be united with the Greeks of Europe. And of course, the Ottoman Turks did not take kindly to this and considered them to be Kufar Harbi, which is infidels at war with Islam. And so many were massacred, many were enslaved, and many were killed, many were forcibly converted to Islam. And so my family was from Tsezmes near Smyrna, what is now Izmir, and Çeşme. And Tsezmes is a very nice town on the coast of the Adriatic, and right across from Chios, and they were exiled from there in 1918, my grandparents, because they declined the invitation to convert to Islam and be able to remain there as Muslims. And so they got out, and my great-grandfather was killed, but my grandparents were able to get out and ultimately made their way to the United States, to New York City. And so when I was growing up, I was very young, I would listen, ask them about it, and they would tell me some stories. My grandmother in particular told me some stories about how wonderful it was over there, and how she used to hear the call of the muezzin in the minaret, and how beautiful it was, which is, of course, something that Barack Obama said much later to the New York Times, that the call of, to prayer for the Muslims from the minaret was the most beautiful sound on earth. And in any case, they told me all these wonderful stories about how great it was, which only led to my question, well, then why are you here? Why aren't you still there? Well, we were exiled. And why were you exiled? And then they couldn't tell me or wouldn't tell me, so I wanted to know and started to study these things and read the Quran, read Islamic literature, because the history of the area, the more I was able to piece together about it, led straight to Islam. And then the reading of these Islamic texts didn't make me want to convert to Islam, but it did make me fascinated, so I kept reading and studying. And you know how one thing leads to another. I never expected to be doing this, but it seems to me to be necessary to do, particularly after 9/11. I was consulting with some people privately about Islam in the 90s, but after 9/11 I was asked by one of them to give a... an explanation of what was happening, since no explanation that was truthful seemed to be forthcoming at that time in the establishment media.
In concert with what you're just talking about, is very, very fascinating. All our histories are, to some degree, how the Lord leads us to do what ultimately we find to be our calling. But you've now written a book called The Complete Infidel's Guide to Free Speech and Its Enemies. And I think it's interesting for people to know why this is commensurate with your studies in Islam. Free speech is no longer free.
Yes, that's right. There's a concerted effort to shut down any honest discussion about these issues. And this comes from the group I mentioned before, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Ultimately, it's been lobbying at the UN for years to compel the West to criminalize what it calls incitement to religious hatred. I explain all this in the book. Incitement to religious hatred, of course, is a very subjective kind of category, a term that really could be applied in any number of directions and in any number of ways. But coming from the OIC, it means criticism of Islam, essentially. Nobody really cares when people criticize Christianity or Judaism or any other religion, but they certainly get upset when people criticize Islam, or Muslims do in any case, and the OIC chief among them. So they've been trying to compel the West to shut down any such criticism, and they've met with a great deal of success in this. When Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State a few years back, she actually signed on to a OIC-sponsored resolution at the United Nations calling upon member states to criminalize incitement to religious hatred. Then she went to the OIC's annual meeting in Istanbul in December of 2012 and explained to them that the United States had the First Amendment, and the First Amendment prevented outlawing the criticism of Islam outright. So what she intended to do, and what she would get her allies and friends to do, was to use what she called old-fashioned techniques of peer pressure and shaming to get people to not say what we don't want them to say. And that's really how this has proceeded ever since. Nowadays, it's sort of taken for granted. You just don't criticize Islam. If you do, you will be subject to peer pressure and shaming. And that is what we see all the time. The atheist writer Richard Dawkins recently was scheduled to speak in Berkeley, California. And he was brought there by a radio station that was politically on the left and very happy to have him because of his criticism of Christianity. But then they canceled him. And the reason why they canceled him was extraordinary. They said that they had discovered that he criticized Islam as well as Christianity, and that was just beyond the pale. It was not acceptable, so they were canceling it. And these leftists, the secular atheists as they are, they take it for granted that you just don't criticize Islam. Many, many other people, also in the U.S., they've internalized this idea that you just don't say anything negative about Islam in accord with, as I explained before, the Sharia blasphemy laws. This has gotten so bad that you remember, I think a couple years back, there were 15 people killed at a Christmas party in San Bernardino, California, and they were killed by a couple of Muslims. The neighbors of the Muslims explained later that they had seen all sorts of suspicious activity at these people's house all the summer before the attack, but they never went to police because they were afraid of being called racist. And this is the number that's been done on us, that now that's, freedom of speech is no longer something that people take for granted. It's something that is essentially null and void when it comes to criticism of Islam, unless you're willing to have your reputation savaged as being a racist, a bigot, a fascist, a neo-Nazi, just for pointing out that the Quran teaches violence and hatred.
You know what's interesting is this is coming from illiberal liberalism. I want to read you something that I was reading earlier on in the day from a book by Dr. Benjamin Weicker, where he says that the contemporary Islamic takeover of Europe is due in great part to the dominance of secularism, which simultaneously declares Christianity to be the worst of all religions and welcomes Muslims as the best of all neighbors, even though everything about Islam is diametrically opposed to secular liberalism. As a result, one barely hears a peep from the secular left at the massive extermination of Christians now, but much to the horror of the Christian crusades against the allegedly innocent Muslims way back when. The view of European secularists has always been that anything is better than the Judeo-Christian tradition, especially Islam. And then Weicker says, now you know why the left today seems to love Islam and despise Christianity, even at the cost of its own destruction. The reason I read that to you is when I was reading that this morning, I was thinking about how odd it is that you have illiberal liberals in bed with organizations like CARE.
Well, you know, I think, I mean, that's, of course, absolutely on the money, absolutely true what you read. And I think that the partnership comes from a shared hatred of the West, of Christianity, of everything that makes the West what it is, and in particular of the United States. And so you have people seeing you have the leftists seeing Muslims, and they certainly are not in favor of the left's moral libertinism, but they are, they both hate the United States. They both hate Christianity, they both hate the West, and so I think the left is playing the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of game, and that's what we see here.
And it's a dangerous game to play. Coming in November 2017, Confessions of an Islamophobe. Now, you do a lot of the titles, a lot of the writing, you know, the ostrich with its head in the sand, a lot of that tongue-in-cheek. What's going on with this title?
Well, you know, there's a book, I can't even say the title, but there's a book by the comedian Dick Gregory, who just died not too long ago, and he was a black comedian, and he titled his book an epithet, a racial epithet that everybody knows that nobody dares to say except rappers. And he told his mother that now every time she heard the word, she would just think people were talking about his book. And I titled this book in much the same spirit, that I've for years been denying that I'm an Islamophobe in the sense that I have some irrational hatred for Islam or Muslims, which is the way that it's ordinarily used. But in the book, I explain that there are actually quite legitimate reasons for being suspicious about Islam and concerned about massive Muslim migration into the West, in that this is something that women, that Jews and Christians and even secular liberals, they all ought to be concerned about, because this is going to impinge upon them. And so there, in the book, I make a distinction between the what I call the good Islamophobia and the bad Islamophobia, because actually is by the term Islamophobia, which is, of course, a new invention, Muslims and leftists actually lump together two things that do not go together at all. And one is vigilante attacks on innocent people, and those are never justified in any context. And the other is honest analysis of the ways in which jihadis use the teachings of Islam to justify violence and to make recruits among peaceful Muslims. And that is something that, even though it is condemned as Islamophobia by the establishment media and by many others, it's still something that is worth exploring and necessary to explore if we're going to understand what is going on around the world, why these things are happening, why there is Islamic jihad all around the world. We can't understand that without looking into the motivating ideology behind jihad terror.
I've just kind of scratched the surface on some of your writings, all of your books available at equip.org. For anyone who supports the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute, happy to send a copy of any one of Robert Spencer's books out to you is my way of saying thank you. I really believe in Robert Spencer, in his writings, and in the contribution that he's making to Western civilization, not the least of which is leading seminars on Islam and jihad for the FBI, the U.S. Central Command, the United States Army Command, the Joint Terrorism Task Force. You're a consultant with the Center for Security Policy. You have done so much work with the American government, and you think about where we are today. I think we're in a mess, but maybe you can give us some kind of a perspective. Are things getting better from the perspective of people in positions of leadership and power, recognizing the demographics threat, understanding the threat of global Islamic jihadism and so forth?
Well, you know, when you mentioned that I have done all these things with the U.S. government, that is absolutely true, but it's a little bit old. In 2011, the Obama administration received a letter from Muslim Advocates, which is a Muslim legal association, and it was co-signed by 57 Muslim and allied organizations. And it demanded that I be fired from training the FBI and military groups. I used to go in and just introduce them to Islam, essentially, we'll go through the Quran and the life of Muhammad in a day to try to give them an idea of what the mindset of the people they were dealing with was. And that all ended then in 2011 with this letter. The Obama administration immediately complied, and not only complied, but scrubbed the counterterror training of the FBI and the military, Homeland Security, the CIA, all of them, of any mention of Islam and jihad in connection with terrorism. So since 2011, if you were to join the FBI today and you want to go into counterterror, you're going to hear about right-wing extremists and militiamen and so on, but you're not going to hear a thing about Islamic jihadis and not learn anything about the motivating ideology behind them. Now, with Trump, Trump came in saying that he was going to change all this, or implying, I should say, that he was going to change all this, because really he said that he was going to speak about Islamic terrorism, and he said that he rebuked Obama and Hillary Clinton for refusing to speak about Islamic terrorism. And that was all very well. But since then, he's surrounded himself with people like National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, who have declined to say Islamic terrorism and have actually signed on to and endorsed and spread themselves the Obama view that Islamic terrorism has nothing to do with Islam, and that we cannot speak about the motivating ideology behind jihad terror, because that will only get our Muslim allies angry. And so, that being the case, I really don't know how this is going to work out with the Trump administration at this point. It's certainly something that is, it doesn't look good right now. And we can only hope that ultimately the president will remember that he had promised to bring more reality to our analysis of the jihad threat, and can hope, therefore, that there will be a change. But right now, it doesn't look so great.
Yeah, so you're talking, actually, I think, about the current CIA director, John Brennan, right? He's the one that demanded that...
He's no longer the head of the CIA, but he was Obama's, yeah.
Right, and he was demanding that you be removed, but also scrubbing all mention of Islam and jihad. I mean, that was part of the process as well.
Yes, that's right. It wasn't Brennan doing the demanding. They were demanding it of him, that I be dismissed and that all mention of Islam and jihad be removed from counterterror training. And that was done. And so since then, of course, there has been nothing. If you look at the Obama administration's program on how to deal with the jihad threat, you have Countering Violent Extremism is the name of it. And there's no mention of Islam or jihad. And the Islamic groups to which the Obama administration considered itself beholden were very strict about this. And even when there was a Countering Violent Extremism program that clearly had something to do with trying to stop Islamic jihadis, the Council on American Islamic Relations and others protested, and it was immediately scrubbed.
I want you to give us some kind of an idea of where we are in Western civilization, because I've also read that you have been banned by the British government from entering the United Kingdom because you pointed out accurately that Islam has doctrines of violence against unbelievers. I mean, if you think about that, where are we going to go as a civilization when you have someone like yourself that knows more about this subject than probably anybody on the planet being banned by a government? I mean, it's mind-blowing.
It's an extraordinary thing, and it comes from the British government that's doing everything it can to appease Islamic jihadis, hoping that I guess maybe they'll go lightly with Britain, so that we have numerous jihad preachers who have been admitted into Britain. As a matter of fact, I just put up a list today at Jihad Watch because they banned one, which is very unusual. There was a Muslim cleric who was set to actually address the British Parliament, but he has in the past called openly for the destruction of Britain. And yet he was going to be admitted to Britain and brought to speak at the Parliament. And this was an extraordinary situation. It got quite a lot of publicity. And just today, the UK government banned him from entering the country. And I noted at Jihad Watch that that's all very well, but there are plenty of other jihad preachers who have been admitted into Britain by the British government. And yet, three Iraqi bishops, not just me, but three Iraqi bishops from areas where Christians were persecuted and driven out of the homelands that they had inhabited since the time of Christ himself, they were also recently banned from entering Britain. And so really, Britain has gone mad. You know, you can't really sugarcoat it. It's just astonishing what's happened. They have been hounding and persecuting people who are trying to call attention to the jihad threat and allowing in those who actively preach jihad.
Where is all of this going from your perspective? I mean, we see the terrorist attacks, they're like the waves, but there's a riptide underneath the surface, and I think it's demographic to a large degree. But where do you think all of this is going to go?
There's going to be large-scale civil strife in the West, unless there is a massive reversal of immigration policies and a massive reevaluation of policies that have allowed Islamic groups to set up all over Europe essential enclaves that are essential enclaves, what are essentially enclaves, I should say, that are allowing Islamic law to be implemented at the expense of the law of the land.
Kind of interesting as you talk about the fact that it's old news that you were doing training for the U.S. government and various agencies and so forth. But I suppose in some ways it may be old news in terms of getting invitations to speak at a lot of the universities that you've spoken at in the past.
Well, yeah, actually, I went quite a few years without getting any invitations to universities. In 2007, I spoke it quite a lot, and then a few years passed. But it's interesting to note that the Young Americas Foundation, which is a wonderful group, a student group of national extent, they have been trying to instill a little more courage in the students on campuses, conservative students on campuses. And this is all to the good, because for years they have been really too frightened to bring in conservative speakers on many campuses. And this is entirely understandable because, you know, while I appreciate being able to speak on campuses, I know that the students have it much worse than I do. I get to leave town, whatever town it is, but they don't. They have to stay there for 4 years. And if they bring in somebody like me, they often will be abused and sometimes even physically menaced for quite some time thereafter, and certainly ostracized, vilified, smeared, demonized, and so on. But because of YAF, I did speak at three campuses this past spring. One of them I use the term speak quite loosely because I really didn't get to say much. I just stood there and got screamed at for an hour and a half by fascists who style themselves to be anti-fascists. Colleges in general, even the other two where I did speak, they were extraordinarily inhospitable. It was as if Jack the Ripper was coming to campus. And you know, Hank, if I had been a Guantanamo inmate who went onto campus and started screaming death to America, I would have been celebrated as a hero on any of those campuses. But if you come in and say there is a problem with Islamic Jihad and free societies are at risk, then you're a tremendous villain on college campuses today.
What kind of a reception do you get on national television and radio shows today?
Well, you know, I was recently on Tucker Carlson's Fox show and Fox and Friends, and also Varney on Fox Business. And I commend them all for being interested in dealing with the issue, because actually the reason why I was on was I was sort of part of a news story because PayPal, the online payment site, they banned Jihad Watch from receiving donations because we were so classified as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, of course, the Southern Poverty Law Center only classifies as hate groups that dissent from its far-left agenda, and they have made a business of demonizing legitimate groups on the right by lumping them in with real hate groups like the KKK and neo-Nazis. And recently they refused to classify Antifa, the violent group of leftist thugs, as a hate group. So their hate group list is highly politically biased and essentially worthless. Nonetheless, it was taken up by PayPal after a hit piece ran in a leftist publication that was asking PayPal why they would allow a hateful fellow like me to use their services, and they dropped me. And there was an outcry, and I was on these Fox shows, and PayPal actually reversed itself, which is refreshing. But it indicates that these groups, although they are enthralled to the left to a tremendous degree, they are still susceptible to public pressure, and that we need to become more active and to work to bring that pressure wherever we can in the service of justice. In any case, it was fun. It was good to be on Fox, and I appreciate all three of those shows for allowing this to be discussed, because, of course, the implications are far beyond me personally. I may be a terrible fellow in every way, but if PayPal and other online platforms are going to start refusing their service to groups because they don't like their politics, then really everyone is at risk, and free society is itself at risk, because once you do that, any group that gains power can do the same thing to groups that are not in power. And it's really the road to tyranny rather than the free society that we have enjoyed up to now.
I can't help but hear the echo of Christ's words, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven." I think that applies to you. You've pointed out that we must speak the truth in love, but our obligation to be charitable must never overwhelm our responsibility to bear witness to the truth. In other words, we cannot shy away from that.
Well, this is very important, Hank. I think a lot of Christians have the idea that charity equals niceness, and that, you know, for example, there's so many efforts at Muslim-Christian dialogue where the Christian party into the dialogue doesn't dare bring up any unpleasant facts or issues of Christian persecution because they don't want to offend the Muslims in the dialogue. And, you know, I don't think that's charity. I don't think it's either charity or productive in the slightest degree to ignore or gloss over or deny unpleasant realities. If you're going to have a dialogue, you ought to dialogue about those difficult things if you really want to stop them, if you want to make any headway against the persecution of Christians. But for example, a few years ago, I was invited to speak to a Catholic organization, and then the local bishop, Robert McManus of Worcester, Massachusetts, actually canceled me and explained that he was canceling me because I would be speaking about Muslim persecution of Christians, and that could harm the wonderful dialogue they were having with Muslims in the Boston area. I thought about that when the Boston Marathon bombings happened, because those young men who carried out the Boston Marathon bombings, they were members of the Islamic Society of Boston that McManus was in dialogue with, and apparently the dialogue didn't help enough to prevent that those bombings. And more than that, of course, you have the problem of the fact that if you're going to avoid speaking about the Muslim persecution of Christians, then how is the dialogue helping anything? If you can't, it's not helping a single Christian from, it's not preventing a single Christian from being persecuted, it's not keeping a single church from being destroyed, what good is it? And what McManus had inadvertently acknowledged by saying that was that he was essentially submitting to the Islamic rules here again regarding blasphemy. The idea that you don't criticize Islam, you don't criticize Muhammad, you don't criticize the Quran, you don't criticize the Muslim behavior, the Muslim persecution of Christians, because that would, that's beyond the pale as far as Islamic law is concerned. And so he, I don't think he realized it, of course, but the dialogue that he was so anxious to preserve, even though it was worthless, was essentially leading him to submit to Sharia blasphemy restrictions.
You know, the mantra, Islam is a religion of peace and tolerance, a lot of people rationalize saying this because they say, if you say it, then the intolerance of Muslims will stay underground. If you don't, you're going to exacerbate hostilities that otherwise would be dormant. Talk for a moment, Robert, about the absurdity of that kind of reasoning.
Well, it's the classic Dhimmi mentality, the mentality of the subjugated people under the rule of Islamic law who know that they must not criticize Islam on pain of death, and so they don't say anything negative about even how they're being treated, because the way they're being treated is based on Islamic law, and if they call attention to that, then they are essentially criticizing Islam, and the things will go even worse for them. Now, I think that this is another kind of counterfeit charity and counterfeit prudence in this case, that you have people thinking that they must not call attention to how they're being mistreated or how others are being mistreated, if because that will only make it worse. Well, it may make it worse by the actions of the persecutor, but it may also draw the attention of people who can stop the persecutor. And so I think we have an obligation in genuine charity, in being careful to be concerned for the well-being of others. We have an obligation to speak out about these things, to try to draw attention, the attention of the powerful, to these issues so that they can take the necessary steps to protect the people who are being persecuted.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about persecution. We're experiencing soft persecution in the West. There's a lot going on in the East that I want to talk to you about, but I want to tell you about your personal experience. I mean, you've been persecuted. I think that word really applies to you. You've actually been poisoned in Iceland, as I understand it. Give us a little color commentary on what your life has been as a result of speaking the truth in love.
Well, yeah. I think the certainly, yes, I was poisoned in Iceland, and that was by a putative well-wisher who came over to our table at a restaurant after a successful, very successful event we had there. And he leaned over the table, shook my hand, and later on I was quite ill for a while and spent the night in the hospital. And that it seems that the most likely explanation is that there was poison in my system, so it seems likely that he dropped it into the drink that I had there while he leaned over the table. In any case, he did that probably because he's a leftist and thought that he was doing something righteous to make the putative fascist Nazi or whatever ill. But that was one thing. I think that the main thing that has been, in terms of what you might call persecution, that might be a bit, bit much, but I mean, certainly people, Christians are being persecuted and losing their homes, losing their lives. I wouldn't presume to put myself in that category. But certainly in terms of ostracism, in terms of opprobrium and vilification, not just from the left, which I kind of expect at this point, and from Islamic groups in the United States that are connected to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, that's one thing. But also, for example, I mentioned before the one bishop, McManus of Worcester, but the entire Catholic Church, really, you can put down as not on my side. A few years back, I spoke at a Lutheran conference in Texas, and they were very nice people who were very quite welcoming. But the Lutheran bishop who had invited me told me a very interesting thing while I was there. He said that this particular Lutheran group, they had a representative from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops at their annual conference, where I was the keynote speaker that year, at their annual conference every year. And yet this year, that particular year, 2015, when they discovered that I was the keynote speaker, they pulled out. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops wants nothing to do with the idea that Islam is not a religion of peace. And I even had a Catholic prelate, a Monsignor, who is the president of Donnelly College in Kansas City, Kansas, Monsignor Stuart Swetland. And we debated about whether Islam is a religion of peace on a radio show last year. And then he actually claimed at the end of the debate, and then later in some written material, that it was actually the teaching of the Catholic Church that Islam is a religion of peace, and that you can't be a faithful Catholic without believing that Islam is a religion of peace. And so I thought, well, if that's the case, then I just won't. I just cannot be a faithful Catholic. But certainly, many other bishops have canceled my appearances, and the Catholic Church is committed as an institution to Pope Francis and his false statements about how the religion of Islam is peaceful, and the Quran, authentic Islam, and the proper understanding of the Quran is opposed to every form of violence. That's what Pope Francis said. And of course, that is because of the creeping idolatry, the papalolatry of the Catholic Church today, that takes pretty much anything that the Pope, anything and everything that the Pope says, is some sort of divine oracle. There are many, many Catholic groups and individuals who ought to know better who think, well, they just have to now say that Islam is a religion of peace, and so there's just no place for me in all that. This is something that makes it impossible to continue. If the whole organization is opposed to the truth, well, then the truth will just have to be set outside it.
Well, I know one thing. In the Eastern Orthodox family, there are a lot of people that love and admire you, not the least of which our mutual friend Father Alex at the Archdiocese in New York.
Well, I'm a great admirer of his, and very grateful. I spoke at an Orthodox conference a few months ago at his invitation, and I was very honored to be there. And a marvelous group of people, and I greatly admire, and I'm grateful for the fact that the Orthodox Church is much more willing to speak these uncomfortable truths and unwelcome truths about these issues.
Well, they've faced it. I mean, you alluded to this, to what has happened in the past. I mean, I remember you mentioning Smyrna. Many people forget about the Holocaust that is Smyrna.
Yeah, they don't know. People have no idea of any of that. And I can tell you, Hank, growing up, even as a young member of the Orthodox Church, when I was a kid, I didn't know anything about this. People didn't talk about it, and I didn't learn about it until later. And I was actually somebody who was very avid to know. I wanted to know, because of my grandparents' experience, what had gone on. But it took me quite a few years to piece together everything. People don't realize that all of what is now Western Turkey, the part by including Istanbul or Constantinople, and Smyrna, Izmir, and many other of the cities in the western part, that was a predominantly Christian area, Greek area, and of course there were Armenian Christians in the western part. In the eastern part of what is now Turkey. Both of these groups, the Greek Christians and the Armenian Christians, were classified as Kufar Harbi, that I mentioned before, infidels at war with Islam. This was the linchpin of the Armenian genocide. There was also a genocide of the Greek Christians in the West to a lesser degree and with much less notice, although both have been consistently denied by the Turkish government ever since. Nonetheless, the documentary evidence is overwhelming. Millions of people were killed and millions of people were exiled, and the areas were completely effaced of any Christian presence. I remember reading about a woman who had a family experience much like mine, but she actually took her Christian grandmother back to Turkey, to her village, which was by the Black Sea. The Christian presence was all around the southern part of the Black Sea, as well as in the western part of Anatolia, or what is now Turkey. And they were asking the local people, where are the Christian houses? Where did the Christians used to live? And everybody they spoke to there said, oh, there were never any Christians here. Christians never lived here. And that's the that amnesia is not just shared by the Turks, but by Western Christians as well, that they have no idea of the genocide that took place there, the ethnic cleansing, the complete erasure of a Christian presence that was going back to the beginning, to the very earliest days of the church, now completely effaced. I mean, of course, we know that St. Paul in the New Testament, all those places he wrote to, Colossae, and Philippi, you know, I'm used to, referring to them, Philippians, Colossians, Ephesians, all of those cities are in Asia Minor, are in what is now Turkey, and they're Muslim cities. But this is because of not so much the conquest of Constantinople in 1453, but the complete erasure of the Christian presence from Asia Minor, which took place at the beginning in the late 19th and especially in the early 20th century.
I don't know that people know how bad this has really gotten. You mentioned Turkey a number of times. The minuscule presence of Christians in Turkey is almost beyond belief. I don't know what the latest figures are, 1%, something like that?
Yeah, it's minuscule. And, of course, the Turks are trying to destroy the Orthodox Church altogether. They have the Patriarch of Constantinople, of course, who's still there in Istanbul. And yet they demand, by Turkish law, that the Patriarch of Constantinople be a Turkish citizen who has been educated in the Christian faith in Turkey. And yet they closed the only seminary for Christian priests in Turkey. So they've created a kind of catch-22 that ultimately is designed to strangle the church altogether. And Constantinople itself, Istanbul, people don't know also that the Turks didn't change the name of the city in 1453 when they conquered it. They changed it in 1918, and this was part of the Islamification and the Islamification of Turkey in general and the complete erasure of the Christian presence that I've been referring to. And yet Constantinople in 1914, at the beginning of World War I, was still 50% Christian. And now it is, as you say, less than 1% Christian, as is all of Turkey.
You know, something that I'd like you to unmask for people that are listening in, I think this would be one of the great services that you could do, unmask this organization called CARE. They now have a platform. I remember reading about them in the local newspaper. I mean, they have columns. They're after every terrorist attack. They get the soft hand glove. I mean, it's sort of you can't touch them. They're lauded. I mean, this is a group that needs unmasking.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you're absolutely right, Hank. They're constantly given a free pass by the establishment media. The establishment media constantly behaves as if CARE is some sort of a civil rights organization, which is, of course, it styles itself as being. They constantly claim that CARE is a reliable authority for a reliable Muslim voice in the United States. In reality, The Council on American Islamic Relations was founded by two former members of the Islamic Association for Palestine, which was later shut down for being a Hamas front. It has numerous ties to Hamas and to the Muslim Brotherhood. This is not just my opinion, but this has been established by the Justice Department. This is something that is very, very abundantly documented, as well as the fact that many CARE officials have been convicted of various terror-related activities. Some of them are in prison still. And the Council on American Islamic Relations, I had a photo essay at Jihad Watch a few months ago of brochures that were available at various conferences, various CARE conferences over the years. And there were so many, Hank, that said, don't talk to the FBI, don't talk to the police, do not cooperate with law enforcement counterterror efforts. So they claim that they are a neutral civil rights organization when actually they're Hamas, they're the Muslim Brotherhood, and they've opposed every counterterror measure that has ever been proposed or implemented. They have opposed every effort to stop terrorism. They claim racism, bigotry, and Islamophobia to anyone who tries to speak honestly about these issues.
And yet when you read their columns, you almost want to become a Muslim yourself. I mean, some of the columns, it's unbelievable. I want to talk a little bit, Robert, about Muhammad. I mean, obviously, we could spend hours talking about Muhammad, but when I was writing my book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion, I spent a lot of time studying the life and legacy of Muhammad. And the more I did, the more I was thinking in my mind, this has to be one of the most evil men who has ever walked upon the face of the earth. And yet, for polite society, for Western civil, so many people think that, well, Muhammad on the one hand, he's the founder of one of the three great Abrahamic religions. On the other hand, you have Jesus Christ and Moses. But talk about the distinction between Christ and Muhammad.
It's very important, Hank. And it's funny, you know, there's an assumption in the United States that I think goes back decades, that all religions are good, that if there's something called a religion, it must teach the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, or if you want to take out the sexist language, then universal magnanimity or benevolence. The idea that there could be a religion that actually teaches hatred and violence, it just doesn't enter into the thinking of most Americans. And there is, because of groups like CARE, now a very large tendency, very widespread tendency, I should say, for people to think there's something wrong with you if you point this out. But actually, you know, the contrasts between Jesus and Muhammad are quite stark. Muhammad was no magnanimous, benevolent founder of a world religion. For example, you take John 7:53 to 8:11, where Jesus is brought, the woman taken in adultery is brought before Jesus, and he says, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." And by saying that, of course, he was declaring that mercy triumphs over judgment, as James says, and that therefore the idea that a woman should be stoned to death does not take precedence over her repentance and has to be set aside in the face of her repentance. So you have that versus numerous hadith. Hadith are reports of Muhammad's words and deeds, where Muhammad not only approves of, but actually orders the stoning to death of various people accused of adultery. There's one woman who comes up to him. The parallel is nearly complete with the story in the Gospel of John, when a woman comes up to Muhammad and she says, "I've committed adultery." And he says, "Are you insane?" And she says, "No, I'm quite sane." And he says, "Are you pregnant?" And she says, "Well, I don't know." And he says, "Go away and see if you're pregnant." And so she comes back later and says, "Yes, I am pregnant." He says, "Go away until the child is born." And she goes away until the child is born. And then she comes back with the child and he says, "Go away until the child is weaned." And she goes away until the child is weaned. She comes back when the child is eating solid food, and he orders her stoned to death. And this is presented in the Islamic tradition as an example of Muhammad's benevolence and magnanimity, that he didn't have her stoned to death right away, but waited until the child was born. And really, it's a horrifying story, because he just orphans the child and does so with the confidence that he's doing something that is good and right. It calls to mind Isaiah saying, "Woe to those who call good evil and evil good." And there are many, many stories of that kind. Of course, Jesus doesn't say anything about waging war or subjugating other people who don't believe in him, and yet Muhammad orders that and calls upon his followers to take up, to invite the unbelievers to Islam, and to take up the sword if they refuse, and to either convert them to Islam or kill them. And there's so many other things. You know, Jesus says to the, Jesus is scourged and mocked and crucified, and Muhammad orders killed people who actually mock him and make fun of him. And he has several of them assassinated. These things are not in the stories of his enemies. These things are right in the Islamic tradition.
They are in the best Islamic tradition. And you have to think that every single Muslim, without exception, swears allegiance to Muhammad. And therefore, there are millions and millions of Muslims that do not have a true valuation on who Muhammad really was.
Yeah, this is the problem, that I think that many, many Muslims don't have a true understanding of who Muhammad really was. We have to, it sounds kind of unbelievable, but we have to remember that if you were to convert to Islam today, which I don't recommend, if you were to convert to Islam today, you would have to pray in Arabic, and you might not know Arabic, and so you wouldn't be able to participate in the five daily prayers. And you would have to learn. Many, many Muslims just learn if they don't speak Arabic. Muslims in non-Arabic speaking areas like Pakistan, Indonesia, India, very highly populated Muslim areas, but not Arabic, they learn the prayers by rote. They learn the syllables without necessarily knowing what they mean. And so they might not hear about these things about Muhammad that are in the Islamic tradition, for the same reason that they might be discussed in Arabic, and this is just not on the table for them. So even Zudi Jasser, the famous moderate Muslim, who is constantly on television as the moderate Muslim, there aren't a whole lot of them, and so he keeps being brought out. And he told me once, years ago, I asked him to join in an initiative that David Horowitz and I were doing, and he said he would as long as my name wasn't on it, because he didn't want to be associated with me because I had criticized Muhammad. I had written about Muhammad in my biography of Muhammad, The Truth About Muhammad. And so I said, well, what's the matter with the book, The Truth About Muhammad? And he said, well, you say Muhammad was somebody who married a 9-year-old when he was 54. He actually married her when she was 6, but he consummated the marriage when he was 9. You say that Muhammad waged war. He had his enemies assassinated. He called upon his followers to conquer their enemies, the unbelievers, and all these things I don't believe. And I said, well, you know, I wrote that book based on the earliest Islamic texts. There really aren't any other Islamic texts that paint Muhammad as a sweetheart. These are the only things we know about Muhammad. And he said, well, I just don't believe Muhammad was like that. My grandparents told me he was a wonderful person who was the best person who ever lived. And my grandparents were wonderful people. And so I believe it, too. And I think, okay, well, that's great, but it's not really anything more than his own private Islam. But many, many Muslims have the same idea, that Muhammad was wonderful, charitable, magnanimous, and great, and good to the poor, and good to the needy and the hungry, all the things that you could say about Jesus. And they just assume this without actually looking into or knowing what the content of the Islamic teachings regarding Muhammad really are.
I think there's a sense in which you can say there are two Muhammads. There's the Meccan Muhammad and the Medinan Muhammad, and the two don't have a lot in common.
Yeah, you're right. That's absolutely true, Hank. And yet we also have to recall that the Meccan Muhammad, who is supposed to, he did preach, at least according to the records, he preached peace and tolerance. He did it because the Muslims were weak. The Muslim community in Mecca, the early part of Muhammad's career, according to Islamic tradition, it was characterized by the small Muslim community, the small size of the Muslim community. Muhammad had about 12 followers or 20 followers. The idea that he was going to command armies was a considerable way off. And that was at that time that he was preaching tolerance, and those teachings are in the Meccan passages of the Quran. He was preaching tolerance because the Muslims wanted to be tolerated. They were not preaching tolerance for everybody else. And when he moved to Medina later and became for the first time a military and political leader as well as a spiritual leader, then he's not preaching tolerance anymore. Then he's preaching first defensive jihad and finally offensive jihad to convert the non-Muslims to Islam or to subjugate them under the rule of Islamic law. And so the Meccan passages are in the Quran, but Islamic exegetes generally teach that because of the principle of abrogation, which is also based on the Quran, where Allah says in chapter 2, verse 106 of the Quran, whenever we abrogate a passage or cause it to be forgotten, we will give you one that's just as good or better. Because of that idea, you have the peaceful passages being superseded by the passages enjoining violence that come from the Medinan period. So you're absolutely right. There are, in a sense, two Muhammads, and one is peaceful and one is not. Unfortunately, in mainstream Islamic tradition, the violent Muhammad supersedes the peaceful Muhammad.
I mean, what Muhammad did in the market of Medina, and this is according to the most sound authoritative hadith or ahadith, I mean, what he did to the Jews is mind-boggling. And I mean, what he did in Medina, in general, to the Jews. I mean, he had three thriving Jewish tribes living there, and by the time he gets done, they're exiled or executed.
Yes. You had the Banu Nadir, the Banu Qaynuqa, and the Banu Qurayza, three Jewish tribes in Medina. They were quite powerful when Muhammad arrived, and Muhammad made a pact with them that ultimately he broke, and he exiled the first two, and then accusing the third of treachery when they were surrounded during the Battle of the Trench, which was really a siege. The pagan Meccans came to besiege Medina, and the Jews of the Banu Qurayza were inside with the Muslims. Now, after having seen how Muhammad had treated the other two, it's perfectly understandable, if true, but the Islamic tradition says, in any case, that they made contact with the pagan Meccans and offered to help from inside. When Muhammad found out about this, after the siege was broken, he had them all killed, had between 600 and 900 men beheaded and had their heads lopped off and the bodies dumped in the trench that had been built around the city to stop the siege. This was the one tribe. The other two, after he had exiled them, had gone to Khaybar, which was an oasis in northern Arabia. And Muhammad then later went to Khaybar, surprise raid, and massacred them. And later on his deathbed, he ordered that any remaining Jews and Christians be expelled from Arabia altogether. And that's why, to this day, the government of Saudi Arabia today does not allow any practice of Judaism or Christianity or any other religion in Saudi Arabia. It's all forbidden because of Muhammad's word.
You mentioned Saudi Arabia, and I think it's important for people to recognize that the threat is not just a threat from ISIL or ISIS or whatever moniker you want to use to designate that particular terrorist organization, but you have fantastically wealthy oilmen in Saudi Arabia that are exporting the most virulent kind of Islam around the world.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, Hank. You know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda are really both Saudi Arabia's babies. They are Saudi Arabia's creations. Not directly, but Saudi Arabia for years has been spreading their understanding of Islam, the Wahhabi understanding of Islam. Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab was a reformer in Islam. A lot of people say, well, what Islam needs is a reformation, and then everything will be all right. And I think here again, people who say these kinds of things, they're not informed. in reality, Islam had its reformation, and it was in the 18th century. Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab died in 1792. He was essentially a contemporary of George Washington, and he determined that he was going to clear out everything that was in Islam that was an innovation, that was bid'ah. Bid'ah is a terrible thing in Islam, innovation. You have to do everything as it was set out in the Quran or as Muhammad ordered it. But Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab had determined that the Muslims were doing a great many things that were not in the Quran or ordered by Muhammad, and so he was going to clear all that out, and he did. And he created what is known as Wahhabism, which is the official religion of Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, when they struck oil in the 1920s, they began to use their oil money to spread Wahhabi Islam around the world. And there were many places in the world where there was a cultural form of Islam that had developed that was simply a retreat from literalism and not an outright rejection of the teachings of jihad, but simply sort of an ignoring of them, a setting aside of the teachings about jihad. And so the Saudis came in, and they had literature such as Jihad, the Forgotten Obligation, which is sort of a self-explanatory pamphlet teaching Muslims that they really should not be setting jihad aside, but they had to be waging jihad, and that this was very important. And so the cultural Islam that had taken root in Central Asia, in West Africa, in East Africa as well, in other areas of the world, was overwhelmed by this literalism that returned to the strict observance of the Quran, including jihad, and set the world on fire. And this is what we see with Al-Qaeda, with ISIS, with the other jihad groups. Really, they all come from this Saudi proselytizing and Saudi spreading of this understanding of Islam around the world.
Maybe something that would be helpful from your perspective, and I honestly don't know exactly how you'd answer this question. I spoke at the University of Tehran and Ulema Tabataba, the Sociology University, in 2012, 33rd anniversary of the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. And I walked the streets of Iran in the middle of the night, was greeted with acts of kindness. Iran, however, in the minds of most Westerners, is the real boogeyman. But it seems to me that I could not have done a lot of the things I did while I was in Iran in Saudi Arabia.
Well, you know, Iran has something that Saudi Arabia doesn't have, and that is it has a history, and not that long ago either, of being very pro-Western and secular. And, of course, the Shah and his father also, Reza Shah, they both were committed to something very like Kemalist secularism. Now, I'm no fan of Kemal Ataturk, the founder of modern Turkey, as I think I've made abundantly clear in discussing some of the history that revolved around the time that modern Turkey was founded. But Ataturk did do one thing, and that is he restricted political Islam, one thing that was good. And he was a Muslim himself, although not at all observant, and he's quoted as saying things like, Islam, the theology of an immoral Bedouin, is a dead thing. And he worked to restrict it in Turkey. He mandated, for one thing, that the imams could not preach the sermons that they wanted to preach every Friday in the mosques. They had to preach what they got from the Ministry of Religion in Ankara. And what came from the Ministry of Religion in Ankara never touched on the political aspects of Islam. In Iran, the Shah, Reza Shah, and then the son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, were both very taken with Kemalist Turkey, which is now, of course, on its last legs as Erdogan is rolling up Turkish secularism and reimposing Islamic rule. But for many decades, Turkey was considered by many in the West to be the future of the Islamic world, and certainly the Iranian leaders thought that, the Shahs thought that, and they created in Iran a secular society that was quite pro-Western. And that was only overthrown in 1979. And that's not, you know, within the living memory, the adult memory of many people today. And so if you go to Iran, I mean, I wouldn't dare myself because I'd be probably arrested and spend the next the rest of my life in some Iranian prison. But if someone has not drawn Muhammad and written his biography and so on, written a commentary on the Quran, then you can go to Iran as a Westerner and you'll find many pro-Western people who don't like the regime, but they don't have a voice. They don't really have any way to make themselves known politically.
Well, I don't think I'll be going back to Iran anytime soon after writing the book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion.
Yes.
And I really am particularly grateful that you wrote the foreword to that book.
Thank you very much. It was my honor, and it's a very fine book. I look forward to seeing it.
Well, you know, I could talk to you forever, and once again, I want to thank you for what you have done. I mean, what you have done is a labor of love, and again, probably the most articulate spokesman on this subject on the planet today. So thank you, Robert. You're constantly in my thoughts and prayers. I admire you very much.
Well, likewise. Thank you so much, Hank. It's been a pleasure, and hope you can do it again soon.
Look forward to it. Robert Spencer, again, you can find all of his books on the web at equip.org. You can order them. Of course, they're available everywhere around the world, Amazon. But if you support the ministry, happy to send out any one of his books, and they're all fantastic. I can tell you I've read every one of them except the last two, cover to cover, and I'm going to remedy that woeful condition very, very soon. If you love what you've been listening to, please stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can do that by letting other people know about Hank Unplugged. You can not only listen, but you can subscribe, you can rate, review, and most of all, share. All of these ways are ways in which you can become a partner with this one-of-a-kind ministry outreach as we are making a difference while there's yet time. A great opportunity, Hank Unplugged, to listen to people like Robert Spencer. I mean, if you listen to Robert carefully, you know that he knows what he's talking about. This is not just academic. He has lived this, breathed this, he knows it. And we have to be very thankful for people like that at this particular junction in human history. Well, thanks again for tuning in to Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with another episode.